Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Elizabeth Rocks is an epidemiologist and public health expert at South Dakota School of Mines and Technology. She teaches in the pre-health and biology program on campus, and she's been helping us navigate the modeling and predictions of the pandemic. She's joining us now with an update and to answer any questions you have about the progression of coronavirus in South Dakota. Welcome back, Professor Rocks. Thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
We heard Governor Kristi Noem and representatives from Avera and Sanford and Monument Health gathered, and we keep hearing that they are all on the same page with the kind of modeling that they're using. And they went through at a recent press conference, you know, the models they had consulted or looked at or used. Epidemiologist Josh Clayton pointed out, you know, the limitations of the ones that they thought for how that would apply to South Dakota. So there have been things that have changed in how we're looking at this situation, you know, really daily, but certainly since the last time you were on. As you're following those changes, what are some of the significant takeaways you have from the most recent data that the state has released?
Well, some of the most significant takeaways that I get from the data that's or the models that are being chosen and data information that's being released by the state is that we are now having large levels of cooperation at high levels in our healthcare system with the state government, which and everyone is getting on the same page and learning what their shortfalls are going to be and how to fill those gaps, which is a major step, and it's going to be very helpful for protecting the health of South Dakotans.
All right. I think we saw keep going.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. As they assess these different models, remember, no model is perfect. We know that a model is sort of it's a snapshot of what's going on in the real world. It's what's happening out in the real world, but it's simplified a little bit. And when a model is made, the modeler makes certain assumptions about what's going on. And that's why we see models that are so different from place to place, depending on what the assumptions are that go into the models, and depending on the type of data points they're going in.
Right. Okay?
So when we start talking about the assumptions that are going into these models, we're talking about, is everyone on the same page about what is the basic reproductive number of this infectious agent? What is the generation time of this infectious agent? What other parameters about contact are being included, or environmental factors? So there's a whole number of different inputs into a model. And as you go through and look at the different models that are out there, they do all have different parameters or assumptions to some degree. And that's what makes them different in part, and also, again, the data points that are going in.
So is there a South Dakota model, or are they referring, from what you can tell, are they taking these other models and using it to make decisions? Or is there a modeler in South Dakota that is saying, here is our model?
Well, what we have is a group, Dr. Jason Ash and myself. He's been developing a model and bouncing it off me a little bit at the School of Mines. And we presented that model to Monument Health that they can use if they like. So that is one model that was considered. There's also models, COVID Act Now out of Oxford, and there are internal models that they are making themselves to really try to tailor that created model to South Dakota and to our needs. So you can use one model for a long-term view and another for a short-term view. There might not be one model that works, especially right now, because the data that we have coming in, although we are getting more test results in, they're biased. And this is because we are saving, and this is for the health of the people who are getting sick, we are saving those tests to confirm the COVID-19 disease in very ill patients, which, as a doctor treating a patient, that's something, you know, you really need that information. As an epidemiologist, we would like more mass testing and get the antibody tests out so we can look at how people are sick in the population in general, because there are so many asymptomatic spreaders out there. It is a really difficult infectious disease to model with the type of data that we have. So based on what our healthcare system representatives are presenting, I do know that there was a lot of agreement among the different hospitals on many of the factors that were going into the models. For example, the R-naught, so the basic reproductive number, generation time, and, of course, how it spreads. So I do think the real beauty of what I saw coming out of the press conference the other day was how everyone really was listening to each other and working together to really tailor the models that we do have to South Dakota. Yeah. Nothing, models are not perfect. We just try to make them as good as we can. And right now, with the data that we have, it's a little like looking at a fuzzy picture. And until we get more good data, it's like you're looking at a picture and you can't quite focus the lens. So you can see that there's a peak coming, but you don't know the exact day. But it's so important that we have good information, or it's so important that we protect people, because everyone is naive to this virus. It's so important that we really stretch that out, if need be, just to protect people.
Are we going to be getting more data? Or are we stuck with the sort of parameters that we have? And what kind of data points do we expect to clarify that picture and bring it into focus?
Okay. To bring the picture into focus, we need mass testing. We need those little antibody cassettes that give you information about whether or not someone is still infected or not, has been infected and has antibodies. And what that would do is, if a person has antibodies, that means that they have had the virus successfully successfully recovered, and they have either high or low numbers of antibodies, but they have them and they are protected. We don't know for how long, again, because this virus is new, but this would also be a key element to helping us get people back to work. It's something where you could test a person and say, okay, I have the antibodies. I know I have seroconverted or had the infection and recovered, and I can go back to work possibly for a certain amount of time. We need to research that a little more, because with this virus, we don't know how long the immunity will last once people have recovered.
Right.
But it would also be a way to capture the people who have seroconverted asymptomatically.
Right.
And allow them to go about their business.
And a lot of people have that question right now. You're hearing it all the time. I might have had this. I got sick. I couldn't get tested. Some of those people are going into the ER or getting tests and finding out their test was negative. And they're still like, I don't know. This might have been it. And that antibody testing would be a way to determine that. Is that coming? Is that something
Correct.
That is even in the realm of possibility? Or is that a in a perfect world scenario?
Well, we would all like to see it very soon. I know some other countries are using the antibody cassettes, the little tests to put people back to work. I don't know, again, how long that immunity is conferred for, but it's absolutely an angle we should look at. Antibody testing would help us a lot. It tends to be relatively cheap. But again, right now, resources, it's a real bottleneck for us in all areas, whether it's PPE for our very brave healthcare workers, or ventilators for our most ill, or antibody testing to help, clear people.
Is that because
we really need to, I think, work with supporting our public health system by we the people asking for cooperation amongst and between different states, who has supplies, how can we move them, really get a nice coordinated effort so we can shuffle supplies around as needed because everybody's short.
Right. And we're hearing lots of reports about how that's not working very well and states are competing for limited resources. It's been a big conflict throughout from the beginning of this. I have a couple things I really want to dive down on. One of them is this idea of, we hear Governor Noem say, like, South Dakota is not New York City. And that's established. We know the difference. And we keep hearing population density. So one of the things I'm wondering, right, when we create models in South Dakota, is it just because the population density is so much lower that people are less like, we're already somewhat socially isolated, and that's why you see problems in a city like Sioux Falls that are maybe more intense? Or is there even something in the air? Are we talking about, the particle matters in the air and that population density makes a difference? Tell us why Sioux Falls, South Dakota, is not New York.
Okay, so part of the reason why South Dakota is not New York is for exactly some of the reasons you've just listed. Our population isn't as dense. In New York, you have a lot of people living in close proximity to each other, walking around a lot next to each other. Social isolation is much more difficult just because there's not as much space to spread out in. Now, something to keep in mind, although we are fairly rural, some areas have more densely packed populations like Sioux Falls, and we are fairly isolated. We don't have an international airport, but we do have people coming into the state who can travel in and out still. And these are sources that can detract from the sort of protection you might get from being distanced from someone. So, for example, we see these clusters of COVID-19 disease in urban areas. But when you model that or map that, you can see, okay, wow, there's a lot more cases there. The issue is when we have travel from one location to another with this type of virus where everyone is naive, very quickly we start losing that protection when people start coming in and potentially bringing it with them from other locations or densely populated locations where there's gatherings and the spread can happen. So we start losing and it starts taking away some of that potential protection that we might have just from being a more rural, isolated place. So those are things we need to keep in mind. And that shows up usually in the disease modeling, again, depending on the assumptions people choose when building their model.
Right. The numbers are very broad. In the last, there was a low number and then a really high number, 30% to 70% of the population might get this. When you start breaking down that math, it's fairly astonishing. And people are asking, why we can't narrow it down closer to that. Is that just tell us how to sort of think about that broad range of possibilities.
Right. So right now, due to the lack of testing data, what we are left with that we can be sure of are percentages of populations. So we know our population, we know our numbers, but we can also say we can run a few different percentages. And we can get these percentages off of other people's models, or we can look at the data that's coming out of other countries. For example, 80% of the people who get sick are symptom-free, asymptomatic, or mildly symptomatic and can deal with it without a hospital intervention. But that leaves 20% of the people who might need extra help. Okay? And when you start thinking about our population, 20% of that number that might need extra help, we're still talking about a lot of people. And then we start breaking that 20% down of people who might need hospitalization and cases. Whether you're looking at 30% of the population or 80%, you're really going to still have a huge number of people. And what you need to do is, we really don't know. This is a new virus. We don't know how it's going to act in all scenarios. And it's really good when we don't have the ability to focus in to at least know the range, at least know the sides of that image. And so you can plan. And as data keeps coming in, we can kind of see which way we're falling in that broad range, closer to the 30% or closer to, you know, the 70, 60, 70% of people having major issues or be infected.
Right.
So
are we always planning for the worst case scenario? Like, are we always just saying like, okay, where we need to focus our efforts are on getting rid of the worst case scenario and then address the fact that if we, you know, if we do that and we're successful, some people are going to look back and say, well, that model was, you know, wrong. And that's not really the case, right? So explain that to people of how we plan for the worst.
All models are wrong. We try to pick the least wrong model. I think everyone needs to realize all these people are pooling their intellectual capital to do the very best job they can in a very tough and fluid modeling situation. Mm-hmm. And with very little unbiased data. And that's why we need to look at such a broad window there of percentages, because we don't want to under prepare. Right. It goes back to that underpreparing and overpreparing and trying to find that right response. And if we're a little overprepared, that's okay. You know, we save some people. Okay. Now we are working on a balance here, trying to balance our resources versus people coming in and what they'll need. And unfortunately, regardless of the percentages you pick for people getting ill and needing care, we are going to need outside help. We're going to need to have different hospitals within the state help each other,
right,
from municipality to municipality. I know the governor mentioned that she was reaching out, trying to get more supplies. These are the kind of things we're going to need to do to address many situations within the modeling percentages that we have or the estimates that we have.
Sure. Another question is really has to do with this sense, and Governor Noem mentioned at her press conference, I don't think it was yesterday, my days are a little confused right now, but she pointed out Beadle County. And right now, mm-hmm. the numbers today, Beadle County has had 21 positive cases, but 18 have recovered. And she mm-hmm. held up the efforts in Beadle County as a success story. Now you look at Minnehaha County, today 165 cases and only 26 have recovered. It was just at 100 yesterday, I believe. It just crested 100 a day or two ago. So this is a pretty big jump. Minnehaha County is increasing. Compare those two communities, which, you know, the city of Sioux Falls and the metropolitan area, because you add Lincoln County in there with another 27 cases. Versus mm-hmm. Beadle County, which was able to have, you know, an early, you know, kind of, you know, everybody pay attention. And now it seems to be we're not seeing a lot of new cases from Beadle.
Right. So if we look at these two areas and compare them, we're talking about a more rural county compared to Minnehaha. And we also have to say, thank goodness we have people recovering. That's wonderful news. We're happy about every single one of those. It does come down to, you know, are we doing the mitigation techniques? Are we able to treat those patients? And it also comes down to a person-by-person health status. You know, do they have underlying conditions? What was the level of their exposure? All of these factors will play into whether a person recovers. You know, what's the health care that they're getting? That sort of thing. Now, comparing that to a more urban area, that's where we really, really have to stress that those mitigation efforts as well. And again, it might be a little more difficult to do it there. There are people who just more people to come into contact with. We know that people just by talking can spread this infectious agent. So and it can hang in the air for hours. So if you're in a place where you're using, for example, an elevator, if someone was in there coughing a half hour before you and you walk in, you could be exposed. That's going to be less likely to happen in a rural environment. So there's all these little sort of micro situations, micro niches for this infectious agent to hang out in both urban and rural areas, but there tend to be more people interacting with them in urban areas. Kind of have to think about your landscape and the environment you're interacting in as, you know, this ecosystem, and where would this virus hang out? I mean, although viruses aren't considered living organisms,
right?
They do use parasitism as a way to reproduce. They parasitize. They're intercellular. They're using intercellular parasitism.
In the modeling work that you did for that you offered to Monument Health, talk a little bit about Rapid City and that and the Black Hills area, and what are some of the things that do you create the model and offer suggestions or recommendations? How do you help people interpret that information? What do you see as ahead for the Black Hills area?
Okay, well, when we're looking at these models, and the one that Dr. Jason Ash was talking to me about, and the one that went to Monument Health, we're looking at the basic reproductive number over time. So what that model does is it takes the last 7 days of cases, and it allows allows a prediction about the next few days to weeks. And then, of course, it's as you get away from current time, the error starts getting larger. But it has done a nice prediction for us recently. And we do see still this exponential growth, where you have growth increasing at a certain rate based on the value from that past day, for example. And what we're seeing is still exponential growth, which means that we have not gotten to our turning point yet for the curve. So as we look at the different curves that have been modeled and made, we see this spread and maybe the peak coming in June or in May. Okay. And what's important to keep in mind is, especially for our area in the Black Hills, and what we're looking at is we're ramping up until we hit that time.
Yeah.
Okay? We're going to have more cases until we hit that time. And then after that time, we don't know if we'll plateau or if we will just turn down right away. Okay, so we're looking for two different turning points. They're called inflection points. That first inflection point, generally in epidemiological circumstances, when you hit your first inflection point, you know you're about halfway. But again, we don't have dates exactly to associate with that because we can't focus in without more of that refining data. So what we're looking at is, at least for the next few weeks, next few months, potentially, but definitely the next several weeks, a ramping up of cases. And we are seeing that. We've gone from, just under 100 to 187 to 280 to now over 300 in just the past couple weeks.
Right. That is that growth.
So Professor, we're going to see that growth continue.
Yeah. We will keep having you back on the program to help us parse this out in the future. It's been so useful for us, so we really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for being here with us today.
Good. I'm glad I could help.